of Radio Free Thinker. This week, the philosophical place of dreams, dream interpretation throughout history, and the science behind REM. Let's begin episode 137.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And I'm Don, your political science philosopher.
Back with you is Jenna, your biochemist.
So this week we're discussing dreams.
It's a theme show and I get to start us off. Isn't that cool? And I was almost late too.
Yeah, that's great, Don.
What? I'm trying to bring some energy to the show. So, speaking of energy to show, I should begin by explaining what do we mean by a dream. By this, we don't mean the, I have a dream that children will be equal or anything like that. That kind of dream is sort of a waking imagination, sort of the, you know, I'm trying to predict the future or imagine myself in the past. We're not quite going through that type of thing. The kind of dreaming we're talking about is the kind that happens when you go to sleep or simply nod off. Later, we'll discuss the scientific understanding of dreaming and its relationship to REM sleep. And that's not the band, that's rapid eye movements, just in case we confuse people.
True that.
However, for those on the artsy side of this discussion...
Sorry, I bet that the band REM also does experience REM sleep and potentially dreams.
So you could have REM sleep.
They broke up, you know.
For
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah,
really. So you could have, like, you know... The band formerly known as REM Sleep.
Yes. Now, side points, distractions, are not dreams either. What are dreams, at least again, from the art side of things, are things, again, that are sort of happen when we're not conscious. That, you know, when we nod off at work or after a long day's hard work, we go home and we go to sleep. Those are what we're thinking of here as dreams. And no, hallucinations don't count. Although, philosophically, that's a whole other issue. What's leading to an important issue here, what's sort of at the heart of our beginning, is how do we know we're not dreaming now?
I mean, Matrix.
Any first-year philosophy course always starts off with the question, how do you know you're in this room right now?
I know the answer to this one. I saw it on Batman. You can't read when you're dreaming. I can read.
But how do you know that?
Because Batman said so.
Oh, well, Batman could be true.
He's pretty wise.
He's a scientist.
Actually, dreams have always posed sort of a difficult conundrum in philosophy. While we're dreaming, they seem real, right? And I mean, reading apart, because I mean, I'm not sure how you would empirically test that. In fact, for those of us who have been startled awake from like a nightmare or something like that, really, when we sort of come back to quote-unquote the real world, we don't recognize as a real world. There seems to be a disjunct in our perceptual acknowledgement of what is reality. And that while we were doing in this nightmare dream, it seemed awful damn real at the time. So, you know, in fact, that we can also find... We often think of dreams as being something like, you know, watching a TV show, a third party sort of thing, right? And in those sort of cases, it seems easy to distinguish the two. But when it comes right down to it, we just don't really know when a dream is not a dream. There is no specific philosophy of dreamings. In fact, if you Google philosophy of dreaming, you get a lot of New Age woo sites about how to get in touch with the cosmic consciousness and dream interpretations, something else we'll talk about later in the show. But in philosophy, this is actually bundled up in part of philosophy called philosophy of mind. The philosophical difficulties that dreaming pose is the idea of true versus false, full caps. The real world has what we call truth-accessible features, or in common speech, we know a statement is true if we compare it to the real world. However, because of dreams, the distinction between real-real and dream-real is a tad artificial.
So just to clarify here, what you're talking about these sort of conditions or facts that are verifiable are things like, I can say in this world that the sky is blue, and I can look outside and, assuming it's not Vancouver in the wintertime, I actually see that the sky is blue, whereas in the dream, you can say it's purple and it might be purple.
Or how do I know there's a table here? Well, I reach out and I feel and I touch the table and I say, oh, well, that table, it's true that there is a table there because I can compare my beliefs with what we think of as an objective reality. But when it comes right down to it, the only objective difference that we can use to distinguish dreams from reality is a subjective feel that this is now real and that then was dreaming. That because there's no assurance, at least metaphysically, can be made to distinguish the two. You mentioned before the show, and this is such a classic statement, and I love the statement. She said, we were talking about this before, and she said, well, you know, I know this is real because I can ask other people and we can agree that's real. But if you're in a dream...
I don't think that's a direct quote.
No, I'm paraphrasing. And you can... This was such a great quote. And I mean, everyone, this is your intuitive thing. Well, I know this table's here, not only because I say it's here, but Ethan says the table's here and Jenna says the table's here. But if this was a dream, the Ethan and the Jenna would be dream Ethan and dream Jenna. And they would be probably saying the same thing as Dream Dawn.
I don't know about you, but the people in my dreams always disagree with me.
I guess the end point is ultimately, we just implicitly accept the arbitrary judgment that what is occurring right now is real and that we just somehow know the difference. But again, philosophically, metaphysically, it's an incredibly gray area.
So is there any philosophical value at all in accepting a current reality versus, like, as...
Ultimately, it comes down to a lot of things is pragmatism. That I accept that I am not the butterfly dreaming he is a human versus a human who dreamt he was a butterfly, a classic metaphor. Simply because while I'm here, it works. And oddly enough, while you're in dream state, you act as if it was real too, because again... you have no choice. It just seems that the two don't have the same rules, which actually goes into a very interesting area that although, you know, we accept that dreams are not real and that this show is, dreams do provide interesting insight into free will and imagination. As we know, or maybe we don't know, we live in a deterministic world. Now, before I get any emails, when I use the term deterministic, I don't mean that there's some supreme thinker out there who, if he knew the initial conditions of the universe and the laws of physics and that, he could predict all of history from point A to point B. What it tends to mean now is sort of a probabilistic version of reality. That is, you have the laws, you have the initial conditions, and you have random or quantum probability, quantum chance. So you can't really quite predict the future, but everything is sort of determined either by chance or by the rules of the road, so to speak. But interestingly enough, that doesn't happen when you're in a dream state, or at least it doesn't have to happen in a dream state. Although we may live in a deterministic reality, it would seem like there's no room for imagination, because I mean everything has to follow these laws to a certain degree, plus or minus some random chance. So how do we imagine the unimaginable? Well, dreams can help provide a path out of determinism. Because dreams exist in sort of a false or a misconstructed reality, they're no longer bound up by the rules of the universe, like gravity. If you're in a dream, we can fly if we want to. There is no bounding us to the laws of physics anymore. So in dreams, there needs to be no connection between cause and effect.
So is that cause and effect what basically determines our world that we're going to call reality here while we're sitting here? Is that the fact that things cause other events, is that what is making that probabilistic determined reality?
Yeah, so essentially the idea is that your brain synapses fire in certain ways, your actions go in certain ways, because again of initial conditions, what you were before, the laws of physics, plus a bit of randomness, because you, at least for the sake of this argument, exist in a real world.
And because those events cause each other, which is not the case in dreams necessarily.
Right, because dream Jenna doesn't actually exist in a world that must obey the laws of physics.
And dream Jenna's actions might not have consequences, period, as well as the things around her.
Exactly. So, you know, and of course, if you expand this, as some of our more philosophically minded listeners will know, this can actually expand to the idea of consciousness, which is one area that I'm doing most of my work in, is that actually you can use this sort of dream reality in areas to explain why free will might actually exist, but that's not in the scope of this show. So in dreamings, we are able sort of to break the bonds of the causal universe. We become creators of the universe, and for those of us who believe in lucid dreamings, which is a bit of a controversial issue in itself, we are gods in those creations. Of course, most times we don't realize our supernatural powers, and we live the same life of our creation. So when we're in a dream state, we usually don't know it's a dream state. And those people who believe in lucid dreaming is kind of thing, it's like, okay, I know I'm in a dream, and I will make the sky turn purple, or I will create a door in this room so that the monster doesn't get me, or some such thing. So that's the idea of lucid dreaming, is where you actually can take control of this imaginary world. I think it's in this sort of disconnect with reality that allows dreams to become a major factor in our myths and religion. While dreaming, we experience an altered reality. We do and we experience the impossible. It doesn't seem that much of a stretch that one could believe in our dreams that we live in this sort of make-believe world, that this is somehow the realm of the gods, the other side. I was thinking on the way over here, I'm thinking, you know, one of the things that we think of the afterworld is we think of, well, it's where we can go and visit our relatives. It's where our relatives are alive. And if you think about it, if you have a dream of a dead relative, in an odd sort of way, you know, they're appearing there in reality, and it seems real again at the time. So how can you say that maybe they do exist, but they exist in this other world? And if you're a little less sophisticated or wanting to believe it, you can actually think that this other world is a real world and not a dream world, that you are somehow visiting through dreams. And it's actually sort of in this part area where we start departing from the philosophy of dreams and go more into the area of interpretation of dreams.
Well, let's take a break from that. We'll go to a commercial break and come back after this with more on Radio Free Thinker.
In the sky, standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
So vote.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So we're talking about dreams today, and we want to talk a bit about how we've come in terms of science and understanding our dreams. So let's take a minute and look over the history of dream interpretation and see, well, how have we been doing as a species over the last couple thousand years in figuring out what these strange visions are when we sleep. So it's likely that dream interpretation has been going on since humans were capable of interpretation. One of the earliest, if not the earliest, that I could find is from ancient Sumer in the epic poem Gilgamesh. The hero Gilgamesh dreams of an axe falling from the sky, and his mother interprets the dream as a prophecy. But she doesn't interpret it as a literal prophecy, meaning an axe is going to fall from the sky, but rather the symbolism of this dream is going to correspond to an upcoming prophecy. So this view that dreams represent the future, either in the form of prophecies, omens, or in some cases literally actually happening in real time, usually through the intervention of some kind of spiritual or divine process, would pretty much remain constant throughout recorded history. For example, in ancient Babylon, dreams were viewed as messages from the gods. Bad dreams were believed to be sent by demons, whereas pleasant dreams were sent by the good gods. This is actually kind of interesting because it differentiates between what type of dream someone is having.
It also seems really interesting that not only, you know, are people trying to interpret their dreams, but I think it's really telling how much import they're really giving them. So it's not, you know, I had a dream and so I think that, you know, this is sent to me by the mouse that lives under my bed. It's like, no, this is from a god. And we're talking about the future, not just, you know, how my stomach's going to feel today kind of thing. And it just seems like dreaming has really, like you said, captivated humans from the beginning of when we sort of started self-reflection. Mm-hmm. And really spurred us to not only look at them really closely, but also to give them really enormous import in our society.
I'm curious, though, that if one of the reasons why dreams are given such import is part of the reason as to who is doing the interpretation. I know most of your analysis is not quite in this area, but I mean, often it's priests or it's elders that are doing the interpretation. And one of the things that I think dream interpretation allows them to do in a more cynical point of view, heaven forbid, don't be cynical, is it allows them to sort of mold what people will do, because depending on how I interpret a dream, oh, this dream told you not to do this, which coincidentally was something I didn't want you to do, and well, to you, the gods agree with me.
Sure.
But by the same token, the fact that these important people in society were taking time out of their busy schedules of other prophesying techniques to look at dreams does, again, look at tell their intrinsic importance.
Well, it also shows that there's a effort to explain why we have different dreams. If we just assume that every dream was a prophecy, then how do you explain the really wacky ones that don't make any sense? But if you can say, well, you know, a really angry demon sent it to you, well, that, okay, that sort of makes some kind of sense.
I love rationalization.
Exactly. So, you know, people are not just are trying to find an explanation for dreams, they're trying to explain why do we have such different kinds of dreams. It's not like we're having, you know, always these visions from the gods. Sometimes they're just sort of mundane, working in the fields. What does that mean, you know? So, human history, very interested in interpreting dreams over the ages. Now, cultures all across the Mediterranean seem to have similar beliefs regarding dreams, which is not surprising because they're very close to each other. Many believe that dreaming was a way to contact the gods, and not just a way for the gods to contact you, but for you to contact them. So we see a lot of religious impact in dream interpretation. There was a trend in ancient Egypt, or there's some debate about where this actually started, but if you had a problem and you wanted to talk to the gods, you would go to your local temple and you would go through a process that's sometimes called incubation, where you would fast and do certain physical things to kind of work yourself into a bit of a fever. And then you would sleep in the temple. And you would dream, and then you would go to the temple priest and say, here's what I dreamed, what did the god tell me? And the priest would interpret your dream as, this is what your god is telling you. And so you get this kind of very interesting concept of tying into religion, which is something Don sort of mentioned there, is that these dreams, I mean, they have such a profound impact on our psyche. And since everybody has them, we need to have a reason that we're having them. Why not?
Well, you know, and I think to drive home how important these seems to be, there's been a long tradition in a lot of cultures to sort of force dreaming onto it. Again, you were sort of mentioning how they were incubating it, right? A lot of cultures will use hallucinatory drugs to get into this dreamland, mm-hmm. or they will deprive themselves or one such thing. Again, not so much to go to sleep, but to bring the dream world out in the waking state, even though, again, physiologically that's misguided. But again, it's if you're willing to do this to yourself to bring on the dream world, it reinforces, again, how important this insight seemed to be to these people.
Absolutely. So throughout history, various thinkers and philosophers have tried to figure out exactly what dreams are. And turning to sort of the Greek philosophers, some of them, like Democritus, argued that dreams were evidence of the divine and that dreams allow for the communication of some form between gods and humans. But we start to see a bit of a shift in that thinking with a number of Greek philosophers like Plato, Aristotle, or Pythagoras. Especially Plato, who seemed to argue that dreams were the soul being detached from reason and rationality. When you sleep, the governing part of the soul, sort of your, I guess you could call it the self-control, the rational, logical part of you, is sort of goes to sleep, becomes dormant, and the crazy, you know, active soul comes alive and, you know, parties and goes crazy, and that's why you have these weird, wild dreams.
So kind of like a nightly Phineas Gage experiment.
To a certain extent. And, you know, Plato's using spiritual terms like soul, but, you know, in many ways, he's kind of talking about the mind-body connection here. He also talked about how you can sort of influence this by staying up all night, drinking intoxicating drinks, and eating spicy food.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah. So, while he still believes here that dreams have some kind of divine component, he's figuring out, and I think his contemporaries are also doing this, that you can actually influence your dreams by, you know, staying up late all night, partying, drinking, eating food.
Watching scary movies.
You can have an impact on what you dream. And if you can have an impact on what you dream, what does that say about this notion that they're sent by the gods? So Aristotle, who, of course, is Plato's student, seems to believe that dreams were not divine, or at least not supernatural. He didn't seem to have a clear idea of what they were. And to quote Aristotle, "For, in addition to its further unreasonableness, it is absurd to combine the idea that the sender of such dreams should be God with the fact that those who, to whom he sends them are not the best and wisest, but merely commonplace persons."
Eh, sounds like a bit of an elitist, if you ask me.
Well, he was kind of a jerk.
Yeah, he was up there.
But what he's saying here is, if these are messages from the gods, why am I Aristotle getting them, and then, you know, Dave down the street gets them too, right? What's up with that?
And especially the drunken guy on the corner, he's got them in spades.
Absolutely. So over the centuries, you get this debate going on back and forth between what seems to be two central ideas. One, that dreams are divine, either a communication from the gods or some other kind of divine in some way. Or that dreams are sort of, influenced by what you do, your activities, your personality, what you eat, what you drink. And this idea is taken up by others like Cicero in Roman times, who argue that dreams are not necessarily divine, but rather have more to do with the individual. In early Christian writing, it's very clear that dreams are messages from God. In fact, the most important, I think, point in Christian history when Constantine converts to Christianity was because of a dream he had about God.
So is the crux in this debate really sort of whether dreams are externally or internally determined or generated?
That seems to be, I guess, what we could characterize it as. I mean, it's hard to say for sure because, you know, the ancients would use spiritual language when they talked about things. So it's difficult to tell exactly what they believed in that sense.
I think one of the common threads that go through all this is whether you believe in a sort of supernatural or natural sort of inclination, that dreams are somehow important to tell you some information that you would not normally be accessible, be it something from the gods or a demon trying to talk to you, or something about your internal sort of psyche that you wouldn't normally reveal or know about. Both sides seem to think that you're delving into some secret knowledge that's available if only you could understand what it meant.
What's interesting about early Christianity is that there was a kind of a very positive view of dreams, and this was sort of upheld by Augustus and Thomas Aquinas and such.
So is this in contrast with the rather negative view of absolutely everything else?
Well, because around, you know, the 1300s, there was this, like, Dark Age thing where everything kind of went to hell. You know, the Black Death, the lots of wars, Protestant Reformation. And during this period, dreams actually come to take on a rather nefarious meaning. They still are messages from the supernatural, but now they're all coming from the devil. Dreams are temptations or demonic visitations that tempt you from, you know, the pure and chaste life or whatever it is. And it's actually kind of interesting because this view of dreams really impacts a lot of mythology. Notions of like succubuses and incubuses and vampires and monsters. A lot of this comes from the notion of, you know, if you have a bad dream, that means you're being visited by the devil to tempt you and such. And it's a very sort of scary mindset for dreaming.
I should say that appears to be some sort of bleed over as well from different physiological states. So things like the incubus and the succubus may have been associated with dreaming later on, but they actually come from a sort of parasomnia state. So a sleep disorder in which you awake but are paralyzed, which does not feature in normal sleep and most people won't experience it. But a lot of those sort of strange and scary physiological experiences that we can now explain neurologically were at that time associated with spiritual or demonic experiences.
And one of the big examples of those these days is the alien abduction scenario,
yep.
Which in previous generations were demonic possession scenarios. And before that, it was the sirens or it was the, you know, Pan, the
yep.
Mischievous.
I'm sure that we could probably think of a pretty good reason why you might assume that it was a succubus if
yeah.
you woke up and, you know.
Well, and it's also easy to see how, I mean, you know, you're in bed at night in the dark and you're having a abnormal sleep pattern and how that type of understanding and fear would then bleed over to understanding of regular dreams and regular sleep patterns as well.
Right.
There's another aspect to this, too, that I just thought about, especially with, as you mentioned, this sort of shift that dreams were kind of seen as good things or at least not negative and how they kind of became evil is the idea of chastity and celibacy in the Catholic priesthood and all that, because as some people may or may not know, there are things called nocturnal emissions, which can be seen as somehow the devil taking control of you to do evil, even though it's a natural part of human sexuality.
Well, yeah, that's why I think, you know, a lot of these notions of sort of horny demons comes from is this notion of you wake up one day and go, oh my goodness, what have I been doing all night? Now, as I've been researching this, I've sort of discovered that there actually isn't a lot of reliable research on dreaming. And when I started looking into Sigmund Freud, obviously one of the big pillars of dream interpretation, I found a really interesting quote from his book, The Interpretation of Dreaming, or Dreams. To quote, "To write strongly on the history of our scientific knowledge of the dream problem is extremely difficult because, valuable though this knowledge may be in certain respects, no real progress in a definitive direction has as yet been discernible. No real foundation of verified results has hitherto been established on which future investigations might continue to build. Every new author approaches the same problems afresh, and from the very beginning, if I were to enumerate such authors in chronological order, giving a survey of the opinions which each has held concerning the problems of the dream, I should be quite unable to draw a clear and complete picture of the present state of our knowledge on the subject." So even Freud is acknowledging that it seems like everybody has this kind of wacky interpretation of dreams. It's not really based on anything. It's just sort of their personal take on the matter.
Well, I hate to bring this back to the earlier part, is the fact that sort of physiologically or metaphysically, dreams are not real. So how do you apply the scientific methodology to something that in any way is anti-reality in so many ways?
Well, Freud's going to try.
Also, I mean, call me a scientist, but I just, no, really, call me a scientist.
Janet, you're a scientist.
Thank you. I just like to talk, sort of draw the distinction between real and unreal, because if we accept the world that we're in right now in reality, which I should just stop saying as a disclaimer because we are, then the phenomena of people dreaming is real. What the world we experience in the dream is not real, but just when you're talking about real versus not real and studying things that are real versus not real, dreaming is a real phenomenon.
The dream state is a real phenomenon. The dream world
yes,
isn't.
That's the distinction I'm trying to draw. Yeah.
Prior to Freud, dreams seem to be considered sort of this random, a product of an overactive imagination, coupled with eating too much or something like that. In fact, I think the literature prior to Freud is quite small and really not terribly relevant. It's not until after Freud publishes his book, The Interpretation of Dreams, in 1899, that he seems to have stumbled upon something that touches a nerve with lots of people. Freud theorized that dreams were wish fulfillment, and he believed that you could interpret the dreams of an individual and figure out their deepest, darkest desires. So he would suggest, for example, that your obsessions as a child are going to impact your dreams as an adult. He would suggest that, in fact, in order to function as a rational human being, you need your dreams to act out your fantasies. Otherwise, you're just going to go insane in modern, you know, society. So he suggested that there were two types of dreams: manifest or superficial, which was content that had no significant meaning but was a mask for underlying issues of the dream. Then there was latent content, and that was these underlying issues. These were expressed in the unconscious wishes or fantasies.
So, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, so manifest content would be something like, I keep having this dream of a train going through a tunnel constantly, and it's like, am I obsessed with travel? And then you go, no.
Why does it keep reversing and going back in again? I just don't
care. Exactly. And where you go, the latent content is when's the last time you got some?
Yeah. Well, and that's sort of the running gag with Freud, was that he had a bit too much on his own mind, and that kind of, you know, colored his scientific results.
He often did have a cigar in his mouth.
Mm. Well, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. So basically, if you wanted to sum up Freud, he's basically saying that dreams are our way of acting out our dark fantasies. And if we didn't dream, our fantasies would overwhelm us and drive us insane. And all the imagery in our dreams can be interpreted as something else. So we gain insight into our own psyche by analyzing the content in our dreams. Now, Carl Jung, who was a student of Freud, disagreed with him, but he still believed that dreams represented dreamers' wishes. These dreams would enable them to realize the things that they wanted. It would sort of help them sort of focus their mind, understand, you know, where they are, who they are, where they're going, that sort of thing. And so, you know, you kind of get this, I guess, slightly toned down version of Freud in Jung here.
I feel like I sort of agree with Freud on one point, but not what he was meaning. I think that you probably can learn a lot about your own psyche by interpreting your dreams, but not so much because of what the dreams themselves are, but by what you come up with through their interpretation, which would mean that it's really not worth anything to have someone else interpret them.
No, well, it's like talk therapy, right?
Yeah.
You know, which, I mean, it's not that the therapist is doing anything, but it's allowing you, although again, controversial areas. One of the other interesting things about Carl Jung and his idea of the dream state and that is he had the idea of the cosmic consciousness. He was one of the people that thinks we're all connected in some kind of unified consciousness. And through the dream state is one of the ways that we can all become connected, that and meditation.
Mm-hmm. And you know, Jung had some interesting ideas regarding dreams. He believed that dreams allow you to uncover and resolve, sort of kind of review all the problems that you're facing in your daily life. So this actually kind of explains why, you know, if you're a student, you might dream about having exams or missing your exam or something to do with your exam. It's like, well, how could God be telling me about exams? Like, that's so silly. But no, it's because you're constantly thinking about it. That's why you're dreaming about it. And so a lot of what Freud and Jung and what others will eventually say will influence some of the sort of more dominant theories about, well, why do we dream what we dream? Whether it's sort of your brain kind of reviewing the day's materials and kind of cataloging it and storing it in your memory, or whether it's sort of like your brain is kind of cleaning things up while you're asleep and it's just, you're just getting all these sort of like random thoughts being pushed into a dumpster.
But that ignores one big elephant in the room, is that a significant portion of our dreams are, sorry to use this word again, Jenna, non-real. As in, you know, I mean, they're pure fantasy. You know, you're dreaming that you're on the planet Quexar fighting the Agarians and, you know, your lasers are going all over the place.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that there's not a photocopier in the corner that confuses the hell out of you at the time.
No, but what I'm saying is the Jungian interpretation and all that seem to imply that everything in your dream, although it may be representative of something else, are still somehow real objects in the world, and you're just using them as props. Mm-hmm. But a number of times, and again, this goes back to the idea of philosophy of imagination, that, you know, there is no connection between what you're dream seeing and anything in reality, which is where a lot of fiction and fantasy and art and all that comes from.
Exactly. And that's kind of the problem with not just Freud, but others, is that you run into this problem of how do you interpret dreams, because there's no consensus. You can't find any consensus out there. It's like going to a psychic. If you go to 9 psychics, you're going to get 9 different readings. If there was something to detect as psychic energy, shouldn't there be some sense of, you know, well, shouldn't they all be picking up the same thing? And likewise, these people who are trying to analyze dreams are coming up with radically different interpretations of the data.
I think it's even worse than that. There's a good joke for an economist. If you talk to 8 economists about their theory of the world, they'll give you 10 different answers.
Yes. It might actually be relevant in this as well. But let's go to a quick commercial break, and we'll come back with more on Radio Freethinker.
Listen, radio is an important means of communicating 3,000 years of habit in terms of diapering of babies.
Well, please tell me more.
Because radio reaches people, including those hard-to-get young people. Radio goes where they go and talks their language, recognizing the importance of contemporary sound.
And the sounds are instantly recognizable as belonging to the in-groups currently on top of the charts.
CITR, 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
It's wild.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. I draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Bread and Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker.
Ethan, I'm annoyed.
You're annoyed?
I'm really annoyed.
Okay.
We've been sitting here and we've been talking about, you know, the philosophy, which sort of says, well, there's nothing really concrete. You've been talking about interpretations, and again, there seems to be nothing concrete about that. This is a skeptical show. I want something I want to put my feet down on something. Is there any scientific basis that dreams are real?
Well, I know, you know, we've been talking about how no one really knows what's going on, whether it's thought experiments or real experiments, and now I'm here to tell you some of the modern science about dreaming. Yeah. I know, you're all holding your breath.
Is dream a scientific term?
Sure, why not? Anything can be a scientific term. When it comes to sleep and dreams, there are a few things that are actually very clear. So firstly, people really like to study them. Secondly, some of the gross physiological features of sleep can be observed and measured scientifically. And thirdly, despite all of this research, there is still plenty of controversy in the field of even sleep research, let alone dreams. So scientifically, it's a really fascinating topic, dreaming, involving an altered physical and mental state that's hard to consciously control. And it also seems to be another one of those ubiquitous phenomena in the human experience that we really have trouble putting our fingers on scientifically. So before we talk about the things that we know about sleep, let's talk about how we know them. So the gold standard for measuring sleep phenomena is polysomnography. So poly means many, graphy is to measure, and the somno is sleep. So we use multiple things to measure sleep. So first we have an electromyogram, and this is an EMG. It's a measure of muscle tone, so it tells whether or not we're tense or very relaxed in the muscles. We also have an electrooculogram that measures eye movement, and finally an encephalogram that measures brain activity, and this is the EEG. So in addition to these techniques, researchers often also use direct observation to monitor gross muscle movements, so basically whether or not you're tossing and turning in bed, or sensors that measure chest wall movements, leg movements, or oxygen saturation of the lungs and other tissues. And body temperature is also sometimes measured. So most of these studies are conducted in sleep labs where people go get hooked up to a bunch of machines, presumably fed a bunch of chamomile, and then go to sleep. So, like I said earlier, there are several basic things that we do know about sleep. So, for example, there are two main kinds of sleep. Rapid eye movement, or REM sleep, that we hear a lot about, and the aptly named non-REM sleep, or non-rapid eye movement sleep. So non-REM or NREM sleep can be further broken down into four stages, and these are all defined by measurements of the polysomnograph. So first, you're drowsy but not asleep, and you have, this is sort of called drowsy wakefulness, and you have low voltage alpha waves on your EEG, so your electroencephalogram reading. So then you start falling asleep. So the very first stage is stage one NREM sleep, and it's characterized by low voltage theta waves and slow asynchronous eye movements.
You're going to use, sorry, terms, alpha waves, theta waves. For those people who don't know what they are, is there like a quick and simple way of just saying they're just different frequencies or something?
I don't actually for sure know what they are. I didn't quite get that far. I'm assuming that what they are is actually a different shape of the wave on the electroencephalogram.
I have some old psychology textbooks, and the way it looks like is that you sort of have these kind of really funky, really fast-moving waves, and then you have these really slow-moving waves, and then you have these kind of rapid eye movements where you kind of get the...
We'll talk about that a little bit later. As far as like alpha, theta, basically just consider them different, and they are different based on frequency, probably based on amplitude. We can just, whether they're alpha, whether they're theta, they're just different. So stage one is the only stage of NREM sleep in which you actually have eye movement. And it's also the only stage of sleep that you might not actually perceive yourself as having been sleeping upon waking. So I know I experience this a lot when I nod off in lecture, and some of those who may be lucky to be alive may have experienced this waking up while driving. So in stage two NREM sleep or non-REM sleep, this is characterized by sleep spindle patterns and K complexes in the EEG. Again, these are just features that have been given these names by researchers because they're very characteristic of this stage of sleep. So sleep spindles are about 1.5 seconds long, 12 to 14 hertz, so 12 to 14 cycles per second, EEG waves. And these are generated when groups of nerves in your thalamus actually become synchronized by a pacemaker mechanism. So you have pacemaker cells that basically force all these nerve cells to fire together. And I find this really interesting because it reminds me of how your heart works, and you have synchronization of your heart nerves and then the muscles by a similar internal pacemaker. And what this really demonstrates is just how controlled and synchronized a process sleep really is. It's definitely not a random phenomenon. So these pacemakers create a regular rhythm by having the nerves basically work together. So that's stage two non-REM, and then you have stage three and four non-REM sleep, and these show very slow delta waves. So again, we're just going lower frequency, longer, slower delta waves. And this is called deep sleep or slow wave sleep. And stage four is just basically deeper than stage three. And that's how those two are differentiated. I'm assuming that there's some kind of cutoff for that.
So once you hit REM sleep, that's when you start to dream.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about the connection between REM sleep and dreaming. There is one, but it might be a little more tenuous than people originally may have thought. So in all the stages of non-REM sleep, the EEG measuring brain activity shows very different patterns than in wakefulness. And specifically, they tend to be really synchronized, like we were talking about, as well as rhythmic patterns. In REM sleep, however, we see low voltage, high frequency waves that are really similar to a relaxed wakefulness. So when you're in REM sleep, your brain looks like you're awake. Which is sort of one of the things that's drawn this major conclusion between dreaming and REM sleep. So the REM sleep is defined by the presence of an activated and desynchronized EEG pattern. This is again in contrast to the non-REM sleep. And you also have rapid eye movements and muscle atonia, meaning that the muscle tone is very, very low. I should mention that from the beginning of this progression, like all the way from stage one non-REM through REM, your muscles get more and more and more relaxed. You just lose muscle tone the whole way through. REM sleep also has two phases. You have tonic REM sleep, which is continuous. It goes the whole time through REM and has the typical EEG pattern of these sort of asynchronous bursts and muscle atonia. And then you have phasic REM sleep, which is sort of superimposed on this tonic pattern. And this is where you get these intermittent bursts of eye movement. But it's also accompanied, I was surprised to learn, by irregular heart rate and irregular breathing, in addition to these brain waves that look like you're awake. So in answer to your question, about 80% of all dreaming that people are able to recall happens during REM sleep, although, as we'll talk about, they're connected less closely than researchers previously thought. And this whole point of 80% of dreams we can remember brings up the interesting and scientifically frustrating point that all dream research is based on something that is self-reported and really subjective. So, I mean, when you awake from non-REM sleep, you tend to be more disoriented and your memory is sort of less focused. And so it's actually harder to remember what was happening in your mind during non-REM sleep. So the fact that 80% of the dreams we remember happened in REM might be a product of the fact that they're just easier to remember when you wake from REM sleep.
So you're saying conceivably we could be dreaming all the time we're asleep, but because of the way the brain is working, it remembers them more likely during REM sleep, possibly.
From what I understand, that's totally possible. However, there does seem to be this fairly close connection. And again, with those brain waves that look more like waking in REM sleep than brain waves that are just sort of, I mean, I assume that dreams in non-REM sleep would be ridiculously boring and it would be like a wave. Because we have these synchronized rhythmic waves. I think it'd be like sitting on a boat, but that's my own interpretation.
Well, I do know that night terrors occur in the delta wave portion of sleeping.
Mm.
Although there's some debate whether night terrors actually has a dream component at all or if it's just this weird thing
terror
people do.
Mm. So as you fall asleep and pass through the stages of non-REM sleep, you pass through them in order and then go into REM sleep about 90 minutes in. So these cycles then repeat 4 to 7 times throughout the night, with stage 3 and stage 4 non-REM sleep being the largest proportion, and the transitional stage, which is stage 1 non-REM sleep, being the smallest proportion. You only spend about 5% of your time in non-REM sleep. And adults spend about 20 to 25% of the night in REM sleep, although this number is larger for small children, and infants and small children can actually spend up to about 50 to 55% of their night in REM sleep. And again, like I said, each stage involves less muscle tone. And also in all stages but phasic REM sleep, your parasympathetic autonomic nervous system is the one that dominates. So you have parasympathetic and sympathetic. Sympathetic more conducive to the whole like running, jumping, thinking, breathing concept, and the parasympathetic more to resting and digestion, actually.
The bit you mentioned about, you know, how much time we spend in REM sleep and all that and how children tend to do a lot more also correlates with one of the theories about why we dream, is it's to help reset sort of the mind or to filter out the data through the day. And a developing mind, as in because your brain keeps growing until you're in your 20s, may have to do more of that maintenance work than an older brain, which is kind of set in its ways.
Yeah, and I'll go into that a little bit later as well. So the biological function of sleep is, like we said, under debate. So we know that non-REM sleep, the body temperature is controlled, but it's at a lower set point, whereas in REM sleep, you actually lose body temperature regulation altogether. You don't sweat, you don't shiver, you don't do anything. And these effects have prompted the theory that sleep is important for body temperature control. And another theory is that it's crucial for consolidation and maintenance of memory, like you're saying. And it's been one of the most prevalent theories for a long time. However, there is a lot of contradictory evidence, especially with REM sleep, where there are people that either through injury or drugs cannot experience REM sleep. And some of them even seem to have better memories. Like, there really doesn't seem to be too much of a problem at all for these people.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, because there was an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation where they couldn't go into REM sleep and they all went insane.
Yeah, that doesn't happen. There are people that lose the ability to have REM sleep, and some of them still dream because, like I said, you can dream and you're not in REM. And there doesn't seem to be... There are drugs right now in wide use for all kinds of conditions that people take all the time that basically abolish REM sleep. And really, there are no adverse effects that seem to show up.
So people need to sleep, but they don't necessarily need to REM sleep.
Right. You need to sleep. You will die.
Yeah.
And sort of to go with what you were saying, REM sleep seems to be really important for central nervous system development in young animals.
Animals don't dream, do they?
We don't know, because we can't ask them. They do REM sleep, though. All land animals and probably all birds.
And they twitch around a lot, so it looks like they're dreaming.
Yeah, so it's true. My dog always looks like he's running. But there are also, aside from the child brain, there are also parts of the brain in adults that undergo growth of new neurons throughout life. And sleep deprivation, and specifically REM sleep deprivation, does slow this neuronal growth measurably. So there, as I have said, does seem to be this connection between dreaming and REM sleep. But this stage of sleep is also really poorly understood from an evolutionary concept. We can't really understand why it would seem to have a biological advantage that would make it evolve. There's basically no obvious adaptive role.
Well, conversely, there is an incredible disadvantage, because while you're asleep, you're vulnerable to predation and that sort of thing. So there's almost there almost has to be a certain amount of necessity for there being some upside to it.
No, but what I mean is, so if you accept the premise that sleep itself has a regenerative role and a resuscitative role, which is supported by several lines of evidence, the adaptive role for REM sleep specifically, that goes into this sort of altered brain state and also loses body temperature control and different kinds of things, it's not obvious why we do this and why all animals seem to do it.
Well, I mean, it could just be an accident of evolution that higher brain functions somehow lead to REM sleep. And whatever reason it does, this is the result.
Yeah. Well, and the brain section that controls REM sleep was once suggested to actually produce dreaming as well, sort of as a byproduct. And so it was suggested to be what's called a stochastic or random input from this part of the brain that produces REM sleep that also just sort of happened to create dreams because of it had to create REM sleep. However, a systematic investigation of dreams has showed that they can actually, although they can be strange, they are really very ordered and non-random, much like sleep itself, and incorporate many components of waking life. And this seems to sort of go against the theory that it's a random event. So to summarize, as far as what we know about dreams and where they come from, it's almost nothing. Like, we really, really, again, it's hard to study because it's self-reported and totally subjective. Although everybody almost does it, those that can't have no trouble. They don't self-implode, as Freud would have suggested. And we don't know what stages of sleep are necessary for them. We don't know what kind of conditions are necessary for them, and we don't know why our brains generate them or what might be an adaptive role of this, if there is any. So to be honest, when I started researching dream science, I really did expect to find a bit more scientific consensus on the subject, but it seems that the jury is basically out on everything from the specific role of sleep in general on our bodies to the reason we have REM sleep, to how closely connected REM sleep is to dreaming, and to why we dream. So I know there's a lot of questions. Don, I can't answer them for you. And I guess it's not surprising that dreams are hard to research when you consider them as an experiential rather than empirically measurable phenomenon. So the human mind and the underlying neurological circuitry, I think, is really beautiful and complex. I think it's wonderful that it's hard to study it. And it's a bit ironic that one of the hardest things to wrap our minds around is, in fact, our minds.
Hmm. I mean, it's amazing when you think about the massive impact that dreaming has had on our society, and we can't figure out what the hell is going on.
No clue. Well,
until we have mind reading, real mind reading.
Yeah, that'll solve all the problems.
But I have one last important thing to say to our listeners. Beep, beep, beep. It's time to get up.
Yeah, that's going to go over real well. Well, we're out of time here on Radio Free Thinker, so let's quickly go to our skeptical highlights.
I just have one quick one. I'm just going to mention that the Occupy House Street is still going on. If anyone wants to go down there and find out what it's about, show their support. It's at the Vancouver Library, the north side of the building. They're camped us about, for understand, about 60 or 80 people still there from Saturday's big rally.
Which was the art gallery?
I did say the art gallery.
You said UBC Library.
Did I?
Yeah.
Well, I must have been dreaming. So, yes, the art gallery, downtown Vancouver. Go down, find out what it's about, show your support if you want. That's about it.
Next week, come check me out on Cafe Psy downtown at the Railway Club. I'll remind you again next week. That's October 25th, talking about TB.
Alrighty then. Well, this is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
And this is Jenna saying, the real world is amazing, especially our brains.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose, a morning flower.